Today's speaker, I would like to announce that he is to be honored tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock at a convocation in Kellogg Center. The public is invited, and so we'd like for all of you to come to that convocation if you can. We're pleased today to have as our I. Forrest Huddleston Sigma Xi lecturer the only Nobel Prize awardee who is also a graduate of Michigan State University. He is Dr. Alfred Day Hershey. Dr. Hershey entered Michigan State University in 1926 as an undergraduate. His bachelor's degree, received in 1930, was in bacteriology. But as he moved into graduate work, he became increasingly interested in chemistry. This interest stemmed in part from working in the laboratory of the late Dr. Huddleston, who conducted research at Michigan State for 49 years and became an international authority on brucellosis. Dr. Huddleston insisted that his graduate students be well grounded in chemistry. Because of the chemical emphasis of his thesis work, Dr. Hershey also worked under the late Dr. Houston, who was a professor of chemistry and later dean of the graduate school. Dr. Hershey's dissertation was on the chemistry of components of brucella. From 1934 until he joined the Carnegie Institute in 1950, Dr. Hershey was on the faculty of Washington University, where he developed a strong interest in phages. About 1940, he became friendly with Drs. Delbruck and Luria, who were also interested in the same area. Since then, the three men have formed the nucleus of a small group that meet annually for private talks. In 1946, Dr. Hershey developed a molecular model for the study of genetics when he reported that mutated viruses will be recombined with one another to form new types of viruses. This work laid the basis for subsequent studies in genetics that have excited the world of science. In 1952, Dr. Hershey found that when a virus invades a bacterial cell and replicates itself, only the DNA enters, leaving its protein coat outside the cell wall, indicating that DNA alone is responsible for the reproduction of viruses. Since then, numerous other experiments have revealed much more information about DNA and have shown that it is the basic genetic material of all cells. For this and subsequent research in the same area, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine and Physiology last year. It is indeed a great honor for me to introduce Dr. Hershey today, who will speak on the subject, Idiosyncrasies of the DNA Structure. Dr. Hershey.
I want to speak to you about work that began in my laboratory about 10 years ago. Actually, it's nice, it will be fun for you young people, I think, to try to go back in imagination 10 years and imagine the situation that existed then. We knew, as a result of the work of Watson and Crick and others, we knew the structure of DNA. And this structure was very exciting, immediately suggested all sorts of things about how DNA replicates, mutates, all the questions that geneticists had been thinking about since 1900 or before. But as yet, we had no idea, no information as to whether these ideas were right. They could be right or wrong, even though they looked so good on paper. the work with bacteriophages in 1960 had already raised a very specific problem that obviously had to be answered, and that's what we set out to do. The problem was this: genetic studies of several bacteriophages told us that they contained a single, that the bacteriophages could be represented genetically by a single linkage group, a single group of genes all tied one to another. Physical evidence, however, suggested that virus particles contain several DNA molecules each, and probably several different kinds. So this was a contradiction. How could this be? If genes are made of DNA, if you have one group of genes per virus particle, then there should be only one piece of DNA. Well, this was the problem. The eventual answer was very simple, namely that the physical evidence was wrong and there is only one piece of DNA. But to see that and to learn a number of other things along the way took 10 years, which I want to summarize for you very briefly. Now, first of all, we of course then started looking at DNA extracted from phage particles completely as amateurs. We knew nothing about DNA chemistry, but fortunately neither did anybody else, so we weren't at we did not labor under much of a handicap. First thing we did was to try chromatography of DNA. Some other people were working along the same lines, and just seemed like a good thing to try because chromatography had done such wonderful, had such wonderful success in many other related fields. And we were lucky enough to find a column, eventually to prepare a column that really worked. And I won't go into the technical details, they aren't very interesting. But the fact is that this column proved quite useful, and we did a lot of work with it for a few years. And I'll just summarize briefly what we found. First of all, we found that DNA extracted from phage T2 by a rather simple method, namely dissolving the phage particles by shaking them with a phenol solution. Then the protein part of the phage particle goes into solution. The phage particle dissolves, the protein part dissolves in the phenol, and the DNA remains back in the water phase. You've got two separate physical phases under these conditions. And this proved to be a very useful method, still used a good deal for purification of DNA. Well, such a solution of DNA, just extracted by treatment with phenol, proved on passage through our fractionating column to act as if it was a single substance, suggesting that maybe there is only one kind of DNA in these virus particles. I should add, by the way, that one reason this work succeeded is that we did have in virus particles sources of identical DNA molecules. Until phage particles were analyzed, nobody had ever seen a solution of uniform DNA molecules, because previously DNA had been looked at from thymus glands of cattle and salmon eggs and various convenient sources of that sort. But these are, as you can imagine, these are very complicated solutions of DNA, whereas from a virus particle, one does get solutions of uniform DNA molecules. Well, now, the problem was to show that these were uniform DNA molecules. And the chromatographic column provided some help there, because, for instance, one could ask whether you could separate two species by passing it through the column. That is to say, when the material passes through the column, the DNA comes out, DNA from a phage particle comes out as a single band, we call it, a single fraction, apparently. Then one can chop that band in two and ask whether the leading edge and the trailing edge are the same thing, and generally speaking, they were. So this first test said, yes, they're alike. But more interesting evidence came accidentally from the discovery that DNA molecules are very fragile in solution. That is to say, if you shake the solution or stir it, experimentally we usually use a mechanical stir to mechanically break DNA molecules in two. Yeah, so we often, the first sign of that was that we often found that material that we expected to give one band on the chromatographic column would give two. And one of them always proved to be, one of them could be shown to be derived from the other, because if you'd stir the solution experimentally in a, or shake it in a mechanical shaker, the one component went over into the other. And so we guessed rightly that what was happening was that the molecules were breaking, and the column then was distinguishing between broken molecules and unbroken molecules. Now, I don't have a blackboard here, but maybe I can make you see what happens here. Imagine you have a set of DNA molecules all exactly the same size. Now, if you stir this solution, obviously if you stir it slowly enough, nothing will happen. So then you pass it through the chromatographic column to see that nothing has happened. That is to say, it passes through exactly as it did before stirring. Now, you stir it a little bit faster, so you can imagine you just keep trying this till you find a critical speed which first starts breaking the DNA molecules. Now, DNA molecules must break independently of each other, or that's a good guess. So they must break one by one then, so there should be a time when you've broken half, and then you should get two chromatographic species containing equal masses of DNA, and this is exactly what we found. So we deduced that at this critical rate of shear, molecules were being broken into two, and the product then was not broken any further. And this meant, and there were theoretical reasons to believe this anyway, but we didn't know about that. Actually, some Russian in 1944 had published a theoretical paper predicting that very long molecules, I don't remember now what he was talking about, not DNA, very long molecules should theoretically break under shear. Well, I don't know that anybody paid much attention to this, but sure enough, with DNA, one could show this. So the rate of shear required to break a molecule is less the longer the molecule. So once you've broken a molecule, the halves now are so short that at that same rate of shear, they can't break again. Well, this situation in which all the molecules are alike and you can break them one by one to produce two distinct components may now be contrasted with a situation in which you have a mixture of molecules all of different sizes. Now suppose you start stirring this solution. To be sure, you can break them, but you break the long ones first so they become shorter. But you never see two components, because all you're doing is just shifting this population down to slightly smaller size. So the mere fact that you can break DNA in a stepwise manner at limited rates of shear is itself an evidence of uniformity of length of the original molecules. And this principle, I wanted you to understand the principle. We easily could use this principle to show that we really had uniform DNA molecules. So that's two signs of uniformity of size. and other properties too. The fact that DNA extracted without breakage formed a single chromatographic species, and the fact that that species could be converted in a stepwise manner to a smaller species, which would have to be then half molecules. Well, all this was guessed at from work with this chromatographic column. And later on, we proved, or at least got some independent evidence of relative sizes of the things we'd been calling half molecules and so on by measuring sedimentation rates. And actually went to some pains to isolate what we considered to be unbroken molecules from phage T4, the half-length product, and the quarter-length product obtained by breaking halves into halves. So this gave us three products from T4 phage particles that we believe to have a known molecular weight ratio, one to half to a fourth. Well, all this was to bring up the ridiculous notion that in 1960 we had no methods for measuring the lengths of DNA molecules. So the molecular weights of DNA were not known at all. So we had two problems. First, to find a method that would work for measuring DNA and then apply it to these materials. And these halves, holes, and quarters, length pieces, were very nice because if we had a good method, they should give a ratio of one to half, two, and fourth for whatever size we got. Well, to make, in collaboration with Erwin Rubinstein and Charles Thomas, the three of us measured the molecular weights of these things by a method involving the measurement of the amount of radioactive phosphorus in individual pieces of DNA. I won't go into that method, but the answer was that the DNA from phage T2 we were using, actually, is 130 million. And moreover, that the phosphorus content of the virus particle and of the DNA molecule is the same, meaning that there could only be one molecule per phage particle. And the halves and quarters came out to have half and one-fourth as much phosphorus as they should. And we went ahead then and used these same materials to calibrate a method of measuring molecular weights of DNA by sedimentation rates. And I'll give you an example later of a slide showing some. But this is a question that could not be answered theoretically. How would the sedimentation rate vary with length for a long thread like DNA? There are some hydrodynamic models, but they're models. And actually, they aren't very good models for this purpose. And what we found was that the rate of sedimentation of DNA is proportional to molecular weight raised to the 0.35 power. Can you see that? On one side you have rate of sedimentation, which is something you look at. On the right hand you have molecular weight. On the right hand of the equal sign you have molecular weight, which you want to know. And to make the measurement, you just put an exponent 0.35 on the molecular weight, and it comes out. That's the way it comes out. That's what the experiment says. That 0.35 then was arrived at by knowing that T4 DNA was twice as long as its halves, and that its halves were twice as long as its quarters. Knowing from independent evidence, you see. Well, then having this exponent, 0.35, we could measure the molecular weight of any DNA just by comparing it with its sedimentation rate with T2. And we found, for instance, that the DNA in another phage particle, another phage species called Lambda, has a molecular weight only 1/4 as much, 31 million. Now I want to turn to the DNA extracted from phage Lambda, because this proved to differ in a good many ways from the DNA of T2. It differed mainly in that we couldn't do anything with it. We couldn't put it through our chromatographic column. We couldn't get a boundary in the centrifuge. It was just a mess, actually. And we couldn't understand, for a long time, we couldn't understand what the mess meant. But finally, if I may have the first slide, by a special kind of centrifugation, which is now used, most of you will have heard about it by now, certainly, sedimentation in sucrose solution. But there's nothing magic about it. As far as we're concerned, it's just a good way to look at rate of sedimentation of many things, including DNA. And here we have an example of a sample of Lambda DNA extracted from a pure species of virus. But it shows four components, and they're quite well resolved. So obviously there are four kinds of DNA molecule here of some sort. But the meaning of this gradually became clear. First of all, we noticed this, that the first component on the left, which is the one that moves fastest, the sedimentation is going from right to left. And this is just a picture of the result at a given moment. Actually, it's about 5 hours after starting the centrifuge. So that the band on the left is DNA that's moved fastest, and the one on the right that's moved most slowly. Well, starting from the right, the first, second, and fourth bands have sedimented at rates suggesting molecular weight ratio of 1:2:4. Well, 1 would be on the right, and 4 on the, 1:2:3, excuse me. 3 would be on the left. So provisionally, at any rate, then we could call these monomers and these dimers and these trimers end to end of end-to-end aggregates, we would, judging by their sedimentation rate alone. Now the fourth, the second component from the right doesn't fit in this form anywhere, so we just imagine that that's probably a differs from the others by in the sense of shape rather than size. Well, this was just a guess, but I'll prove that it's right. So just to have something to call them, here are monomers, dimers, trimers, and what I will call circles, because that's what they proved to be, circles. The fourth component is a monomeric circle. That's enough for the slide. Thank you. Now, how do we know that? First, one test was to compare the fragility of these various structures. May I have the lights, please? Compare these structures by putting them in our stirrer again. And which made sense, that the things we called trimers were the first to break under shear, the dimers next. And with respect to the circles, you wouldn't know what to predict, but actually they too could be broken before you began to break what we called monomers. Whereas monomers, and monomers only, if they were stirred at sufficiently high speed, would break into halves. So again, we had this much reason to believe this kind of identification. But more important, we started testing the effect of heat on these products and found, first of all, that if you heat up the solution to the solution of DNA containing these four components to about 70 degrees, not hot enough to to denature DNA molecules. But anyway, everything came apart to yield just one component, the one that we called the monomer. And this change proved to be reversible, because if we would cook the solution at about 55 degrees, for a short time, we could convert the monomers in either two ways. If the solution was very dilute at the time of cooking, we got a pure product consisting of circles. If the solution was concentrated at the time of cooking, we got this mixture of dimers, trimers, and even bigger things. So we ended up, I won't go into any more details, but show you on the next slide our hunch about all this. So we guessed then, on the basis of the evidence I just mentioned, that here were DNA, uniform DNA molecules shown on the top line. I've shown it broken in two, but forget that for a moment. Possessing somewhere near its ends sticky spots, which I've shown diagrammatically, the circle and the thing. Then these molecules could join end to end to make dimers and trimers. They could also join end to end to make circles, depending on how you do it. The test of that hypothesis was to break the molecule in two, as I've shown, and then cook the solution. Now, by hypothesis, we have pieces of DNA with only one sticky spot, and they can join in only one way, and that is shown in the lower line. And sure enough, if lambda DNA is broken into halves, and then the solution is cooked, you get something now that sediments at the same rate as the original molecules did before breakage. And you see, and then if you look at the density of the products, and that's shown on slide number 3, please. If you look at the density of the products, you see something more informative. The bands on the right are just density markers. We don't have to look at those. Now, if you look at the bottom line, C, that's just lambda DNA before you do anything to it, a single band. These are density measurements, buoyant density in cesium chloride solution. Nothing to do with size, just measuring the density. But since all the molecules are alike, they all have the same density, and you see this nice sharp band. Now, if the solution is stirred in our stirrer so as to break the molecules into half, now you get the two bands shown in at the top, graph A. You got two bands simply because the two halves of the lambda DNA molecule have different densities, the left half being more rich in guanine and cytosine, is denser in cesium chloride than the right half, which is richer in adenine and thymine. So now we take solution A, a solution of halves, cook it, as I already described, to rejoin the halves together again. And now the result is seen in B. And you see that B looks pretty much like C, not quite as uniform, the reason being that the halves, that what I call halves, are really not exactly half lengths. They vary in length somewhat. But the difference between graph B and graph A is striking in one way, that is that the evidently the two halves have rejoined left to right, not right right and not left left, because as you can see from the density of the product obtained by rejoining. So this tells us not only does each half have a sticky spot on it, but these are complementary sticky spots, not just sticky, if you see what I mean. The right end sticky spot is not the same as the left end sticky spot. They are complementary in structure and join only to each other. Well, so in slide 4 we look at another Just another picture of the same thing. This is then a model, still not a very good model, but these are DNA molecules, lambda DNA molecule on the right, and the sticky spot, or cohesive sites, we call them, are presumably then just overhanging, just due to the fact that the two strands, it's better to go backwards. It looks as if lambda DNA is derived from a circular structure, as shown on the left, by cuts at specific places, shown by those two little arrows, to give rise to the lambda DNA molecule seen on the right. The cohesive sites, then, are simply complementary base sequences, and they've since been analyzed in other laboratories, so that we know they're about 20 nucleotides long. Each end is 20 nucleotides long. And they join together, as already guessed from the heating experiments, by virtue of complementary sequence of bases in these two ends. Well, this was a lot of work to see this, to understand these structures, but perhaps it's trivial. But we think it's probably not. It tells us, I mean, there must be reason for this, and I'll come back to reasons in a moment, or what I think may be reasons. That's all for the slide. May we have the lights, please. Now, in the meantime, genetic experiments with T4, I'm going back now to phage T4 or T2, they're practically the same thing. They're closely related phages. Genetic experiments with T4, in the meantime, all this work was going on, had given rise to some puzzling things. I'll just name the ideas. You've probably, most of you have heard of them anyway. Two ideas, circular permutation, permutation of nucleotide sequences in DNA, and terminal repetition as principles of the structure of T4 DNA. I just want to give you those words, which came not from our work at all. The genetic evidence came from work of Streisinger and his colleagues, and the structures I'm going to define for you were also proved by physical methods later on by Thomas and his colleagues. So this is shown on slide number 5. Yeah, on we'll forget now DNA structure for a moment and think in terms of, I like to call, information diagrams. Probably many of you have thought of in the same language. We define A as a nucleotide sequence of arbitrary length. And the whole point of A is that particular nucleotide sequence, if it occurs in phage T4, occurs nowhere else in the universe. This is unique. Similarly, B is unique and different from A, and so on. I put an arbitrary number up to Z, through Z. Now, the only point here that reminds you of DNA structure is that each A, then, has its complementary sequence, which I've called A prime, and so on, up to Z prime. So structure one there is just what Watson and Crick said. This is what you expect to see when you look at any species of DNA molecule. But we've already seen that lambda DNA doesn't look like that. It looks like structure two. That is to say, it's clear on the diagram, and it's very simple. And we've also, so that on paper, one could create structure two from structure one without gain or loss of nucleotides, just by moving A prime, from one end to the other. In nature, however, these two structures are quite different. They have different information contents because the structure 2 contains a sequence Z prime A prime, which nowhere occurs in structure 1. So in a vague sort of way, then, we see here a biological significance of circularity as an abstract biological principle. It's a means of maximizing information in DNA. It's also a means, incidentally, of linking genes together, as Frank Stahl pointed out at one time. In a circle, all genes are linked. Well, this is hard to say quantitatively too, but at any rate, the genes in a circle are linked more closely than the same genes in an open molecule. That's clear. You maximize clustering. I think that's the way Stahl said it. You maximize gene clustering. You maximize the opportunity for forming groups of genes linked to each other, both functionally and physically. Well, at any rate, the whole point of structure two must be the ability to join those ends together, because that's all they're good for. Now we come to structure three, and this is more a little more subtle. Structure three is derived from structure one by two operations. First, permutation, that is changing the overall order of the alphabet, beginning at N instead of A. And second, by adding adding what is called terminal repetition, that is to say, we've added a superfluous N and N prime so that those are represented twice in the molecule. So structure three is characterized by these two new principles, permutation and terminal repetition. But notice that the information content of structure three is no different from that of structure one. Structure two. That is, both have all possible letters joined to all possible letters. In the same sense. Now, a solution of T4 DNA, I'll first state the fact and then give you a brief statement of the evidence. The chief consequence of, what was I going to say? Oh, so what's meant by the phrase circular permutation is that T4 DNA molecules resemble structure three, except they begin with every letter of the alphabet, not just N, but also every letter from A to Z. So each molecule tends to be different from every other molecule, but they all contain the same information content, and that's the nice difference between DNA language and human language. You couldn't permute an English sentence and make sense. Here it doesn't make a bit of difference. It doesn't make a bit of difference. Well, now how do we know this? I already told you how we know that lambda resembles structure two, and that's very clear. Physical evidence, almost entirely, although it's also confirmed by genetic evidence. Structure 3, which represents T4, also comes both from genetic evidence and physical evidence, but the genetic evidence came first, and I'll just mention it. First of all, as I said, there are no genes that characteristically lie at the ends of this molecule, since here N and M are maximally separated, but on another molecule, those could lie right next to each other, you see. So that the linkage relations among genes in T4 DNA molecules produce a circular genetic map, a very unexpected result. Although it's commonplace now, they're being found all over, but when first seen, it was a striking thing. Circular genetic map, that's one thing. Second, the terminal repetition, the fact here that gene N occurs twice in the molecule, means that one of the products of a genetic cross is a special kind of heterozygous, partial heterozygote. And that would be the case, for example, if in this molecule N came from one parent, The N on the left came from one parent, and the N on the right came from a parent mutant in that particular gene. So then you would have a single chromosome with two forms of the same gene represented. And that means that in T4, you see two kinds of heterozygote, one this kind, terminal heterozygote, and one in which, for instance, A and A prime are not complementary. They're exceptions to the rule of complementary because one represents a mutated sequence of the other. So they're both internal heterozygotes and terminal heterozygotes seen genetically in T4, and these can be distinguished by genetic experiments. Then you see this is also part of the evidence for permutation, because all genes can form terminal hets, and that could only be true if sometimes it's N on the end, sometimes it's A or any other gene. As one other consequence of the structure 3, and that is let's go back first to lambda. Structure 2, as I mentioned, must be formed by cutting DNA at those specific places, because all the ends are exactly alike. So there must be enzymes available to recognize those spots and cut those ends. That's the only way you could get them. Structure 3 is quite different, because here you see the cuts among the permuted molecules, the cuts occur everywhere. And in any one molecule, they're cut in two different places, see? So the cutting of molecules of type 3 must occur by measuring. And it could measure in either two ways. It could measure the total length, or it could measure the length of the repetition. And how would you distinguish those alternatives? Well, in this way, suppose we derive from phage T4 a product with a genetic deletion. So suppose, for instance, we've taken out gene A. Now, if the infected cell is going to correct for this deletion by measuring the terminal redundancy, then the total length, by measuring the terminal repetition, then the total length of the DNA would shrink, and the length of the repetition would remain constant. On the other hand, if the infected cell measures the total length of the molecule, then the effect of a deletion would be to increase the length of the terminal repetition. And these two predictions are distinguishable by genetic experiments, and Streisinger found that actually the effect of deletions is to increase the length of the terminal repetition, so that somehow in the infected cell, T4 DNA molecules are produced from something longer, presumably, by measuring lengths and cutting at the end of the measurement. Well, the common feature of both 2 and 3, nevertheless, is some sort of abstract principle of circularity. It shows up quite differently in these two cases, and that's why I mention it, why I like to show these. And so we ask why we find in these, which were really the first two phages to be looked at closely, why we should find these two peculiar DNA structures and never so far structure 1. Well, the answer, just guessing now, I would say the answer may be that the ends of structure 1, the ends of any DNA structure may be pretty hard to reproduce. You can imagine if you start an enzyme working at an end, it looks like a mechanically precarious problem. So lambda evidently gets around that difficulty by abolishing ends entirely, by forming circles. T4 gets around it in a different way by putting repetitions in its end, so it doesn't matter if you make a few mistakes there. Thanks, that's all I want to see.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hershey. Dr. Hershey did say that he would answer a question if anyone has one. If not, again, thank you a great deal, Dr. Hershey, and I hope that all of you will be at the convocation tomorrow when Dr. Hershey receives an honorary degree from his alma mater.